It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferretz. Today on the show, we're talking with the candidates competing in next week's primary election in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Before the news, we heard from Republican Don Rahela, who's running against incumbent Sean Duffy in the primary. Now we turn to the two Democrats on the ballot, beginning with Kelly Westland. She's a small business owner in northern Wisconsin and serves on the Ashland City Council. She's one of the Democratic candidates in this race for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Her primary opponent is Mike Gracine. Kelly Westland joins us from our studios in Superior. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with why you decided to run for Congress.
Well, I have a background that has largely been focused on building coalitions to solve problems. And when I considered the person currently representing me in the 7th Congressional District, I honestly believe that I'm capable of making better decisions and being a better representative of the people in my community. So I felt compelled to challenge him.
Now, you're a relative newcomer to Wisconsin's political scene. Does that help or hinder you?
I think it's a little bit of both. One, obviously, I've got to work on name recognition, make sure that voters know a little bit about my background. But I'm not really that much of a newcomer. I have served on city council since 2011, but I've also been engaged with the party for a number of years and have been involved as an activist for a decade or more.
And what else in your background would set you up for Congress?
Well, I have a degree in conflict resolution, so I think some skills there that could be put to very good use in Congress, for starters. But I grew up in a military family, have lived in communities across the country and gotten to know people from all walks of life. And professionally, my work has focused on helping communities become more self-reliant, whether that's through renewable energy or local food systems or economic development. There are a lot of lessons learned that I think could be applied across the board at the federal level.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing your district in northern Wisconsin?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. We've been having roundtable discussions throughout the district on a number of focuses. Lately, it's been veterans issues, but also my background working with family farmers and trying to understand the needs and concerns of folks like that in this district. We have a broad rural area. You know, this district is twice the size of New Hampshire. And oftentimes we don't have the kinds of resources that we need to really build up infrastructure that would promote economic development. I would love to see more investment in not just education, but also in our infrastructure that will help make our communities more competitive, whether that's, you know, fixing our roads and bridges or expanding access to broadband internet. All of these things are the core of what can help, you know, build the populations in our communities and make sure that we all have the chance to be successful.
Are there any particular investments in terms of agriculture apart from the infrastructure in that large rural district that you'd like to see?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, we've got these really wonderful growing sectors of sort of the more localized version. There was a study done a few years back that showed that the communities in northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota were exporting billions of dollars a year to import food. And at the same time, we have the capacity to produce a lot of that right here. And that means, one, keeping those dollars local, but two, creating products that we can then export to bring money back in. My work with the Bayfield Regional Food Producers Cooperative over the last few years is a great example of some of the things that we can do when we get people to work together and build up the infrastructure that they rely on, whether it's for actually, you know, working on the farm or aggregating their products, packaging their products and distributing them to customers, and also some of the skills that come as far as customer service and logistics, that sort of thing. There is so much opportunity to really step up the capacity for agriculture to do good things for northern Wisconsin. And I think that's a great place to start.
Well, another sector of the economy has gotten a lot more attention there, and that is mining. The iron mine has been a big subject for debate in that area and in the state as a whole. Would you support the proposed iron mine project in northern Wisconsin?
I am opposed to that project for a number of reasons. One, if the goal is to create jobs, this mine is a job killer. All of the economic opportunity that shows any real momentum in northern Wisconsin right now is focused on things like agriculture, forestry, tourism, outdoor recreation, fisheries. And all of those things are put at risk if we allow this particular company to move forward under this regulatory framework that we have, the new mining law. It's just taking other opportunities off the table. And I think the local opposition is so strong that I don't really see that project moving forward.
But won't it in itself bring a lot of jobs and probably better paying the jobs than in sectors like tourism?
That may be the case, but one, we know that we can look at empirical examples of other communities that have relied on this sort of mining operation. It's a boom and bust economic cycle, for one thing. It's a finite resource, and when that resource is gone, we have to have diversity in our economy so that we can make sure that our communities are stable moving forward. The other thing is that this company cannot be trusted. We've heard them tell us that they're going to be good paying jobs, that they're going to be union jobs, that they're going to go to the locals. But the fact is, they've also talked about this being one of the most state-of-the-art mines. And if you look at state-of-the-art mines, much of the work is actually automated. They don't employ as many people as they used to. And chances are pretty good that these are highly technical jobs, that they'll bring in workers from other states that already have those skills. There's no guarantee that they'll be unionized either.
You've in the past made a point of saying that one of your first priorities would be an increase in the minimum wage, I think, to $10 an hour. Make the case for that.
Sure. I think $10 is a great starting point, 10-10. But I think the best way to illustrate it is to look at, you know, the classic example, Walmart. There was a study that came out recently that said that 52% of Walmart employees rely on public assistance of some form. To me, that says that those people aren't being paid enough, and therefore they're relying on taxpayers to help them make ends meet, to help keep them out of poverty. And that means that while Walmart is just colossally profitable, they are making those profits on the backs of taxpayers. Taxpayers are subsidizing their cost of doing business because they're not paying their employees enough. If we raise the minimum wage so that people working full-time are above poverty level, then that means that they won't have to rely on those other programs, and we can save those taxpayer dollars.
Now, the reality is, even if elected, you'll probably be in the minority party in the House, the way things look now, in a divided Congress. How do you reach across the aisle to work on the minimum wage or any issue for that matter? How would you help overcome gridlock to get something done?
Sure. Well, I think that anytime you have to get past something like that, it starts with one person taking the initiative to extend the olive branch, but to also get folks who are also frustrated with the gridlock to sit down in the same room together. And instead of, you know, fighting with one another from your own position, you sit on the same side of the table and look at the problem ahead of you. And you work together to say, we have this shared challenge. How do we solve it? You know, what are the mutual benefits that we can identify to make sure that everybody gets, you know, their basic needs met and we can solve this problem as a whole? We have so much in common that, you know, it's frustrating that Congress is fighting over the few things where we're so divided. And instead of, you know, working together to move this country forward, we're left with the least productive Congress in the history of our country when we're facing real problems. I think that people are ready to see a change.
You have a primary to get through first. How do you distinguish yourself from your opponent on the Democratic side of the ballot, Mike Crisine?
Well, I have been a member of the party, though I'm certainly one to point out when I think that there's room for improvement. I believe that if I want a party and a country that I can be proud of, then it's up to me to engage, to take my seat at that table and be a part of guiding the discussion in a way that makes sense. And I know that Mr. Crisine joined the Democratic Party this past May, just before he announced that he was running on the Democratic ticket. But as far as our substantial policy positions, we're very, very different. I think that he and I can agree that you know, the big banks on Wall Street that are bigger now post-reform than they were before, that they need to be held accountable for the harm that they did to our economy. But at the same time, I believe in a woman's right to make her own choices as far as her family planning and healthcare decisions are concerned. I guess I don't really know much else about where he stands, but I know that in the past when he's run for office, he's run as an independent libertarian or Republican, something closer to that end of the spectrum.
Turning to an issue that got left on the table last week as the congressional session ended, immigration and the tens of thousands of Central American youth detained at the border. What would you like to have seen come out of Congress and go to the president?
It's such a troubling situation. We have these children who are coming here as seeking help, and they're coming from a very dangerous place. It's the murder capital of the world in Honduras right now, and they're fleeing from, you know, a terrible situation. And for Republicans to say, well, we should just send them back, you're literally saying, let's send children back into harm's way. That's not the America that I know. I think that we need to take a step back and consider our values and really put ourselves in the shoes of the people that are there. These children are coming because their parents really believe that they are better off far from home in a place where they might have the potential opportunity. And again, it's one of these things where we're smart people. We are capable, creative, innovative people. I'm sure that we can come up with a better solution than what was put through Congress or largely more likely left waiting for a solution. We have families across this country that would be willing to welcome these children with open arms and give them a safe place to be until we can do something else to resolve the situation in Central America that will hopefully address the problems that we're having.
Very briefly, a final message to voters.
Well, you know, this is a government for and by the people, or at least it's supposed to be. And corporate campaign contributions will keep drowning citizen voices until we each show up and take our seat at the table. Your vote is your voice and your power. Make sure that you use it on Tuesday, August 12th.
Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Kelly Westland. She's the Democratic candidate in the 7th Congressional District primary election. She joined us in our studios in Superior.